This episode is brought to you by Square. If you run a restaurant or business, Square has the tools to help you stay connected to customers, shift your business, and navigate this uniquely challenging time. Learn more at square.com/go/grapenation.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Marco Pelletier. We'll talk to Marco about his wine, his restaurant, and a lot more stuff he's into. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Canadian-born Marco Pelletier studied engineering but pursued his love for wine, eventually heading to France. Marco was head sommelier of some of Paris's best restaurants, including Taliban and the Hotel Le Bristol. Marco left the 3-Michelin-star world to open Vaunt, a Parisian wine bar with an extensive wine list and an emphasis on great food, with former Bristol alum. Marco Pelletier is also the vigneron for Domaine des Galouches in Bordeaux. And can we talk about the champagne?
Of course. Yes.
And we're going to talk about a new champagne. All right, Marco, welcome to the Grape Nation.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here with you.
I've been chasing you around for about a year. You are based in France, but you're back and forth a lot because you're a busy guy, and we're going to get into that. You are in New York today. You have a portfolio tasting. La Pole is in town. There's a lot of good stuff going on. All right, so I want you to give our listeners a little context. You're a guy who grew up in North America, but now has settled in Europe. Give me some background on your journey in life and wine that got you really to where you are today, which is Vaunt, the restaurant, and the wine projects. So how did all this start?
Yeah, it's a long story, but I'll try to be as short as possible. You know, born and raised in Canada, from a worker's family that never had any wines at home and never drank any wines. So I ended up to be finishing my school in civil engineering, as you just said a little bit earlier. But, you know, when I finished that, I wanted to travel a little bit in Europe before, like, settle down to my civil engineer work. And finally, I ended up to do I met a French woman in Montreal, and I told her, I said, I wanted to go work in a little cafe in France just to pay my traveling, because my school cost me a lot of money, so I wanted to work a little bit before. And she said, oh, my mom, I have a cafe. If you want to come, you know, you can come for the seasons. And that was in the summer of 1997. And, you know, 1 week before going there, I said, okay, I need to know where I'm going. And she said, you know, you arrive in Paris, you go at Gare de l'Est, you take a little train, it will be 1 hour and 15 minutes, and you drop off at Épernay, which is the capital of Champagne.
Right.
I said, oh, okay, that will be better than eating potatoes in the north of France. Okay. And so I'll drink champagne. So I ended up over there to be, you know, to do the seasons over there, serving like just Croque Monsieur and beers and things like that. And all the workers of Moët & Chandon and all these big house of champagne very close to the Avenue du Champagne in Épernay, they were coming. I said, oh, gamin, I would love you to come to do the harvest with us. And I did some illegal tasting in wine cellar at Dom Pérignon, for example. And with all these workers, and they were like breaking necks of 1979 Dom Pérignon, and we were drinking that in the cellar. I said, oh, that's fun. You know, it's really interesting. And after all that seasons, you know, I ended up to be a grape picker in the harvest. And, you know, they used to call me the bear because, you know, I was carrying a lot of them. And I said, okay, would you like to stay a little bit for the vinification? And I said, vinification. So my sabbatic summer ended up to be almost a three-quarter of a year.
What year was that?
97. And so finally, you know, after all these like 8-9 months, I said, okay, I need to go back to Canada, because I need to work in civil engineering, which I worked for, and I didn't have my papers to stay in France. It's starting to be a little bit critical. And I said, okay, so I ended up back to Canada, and I did a few interviews in civil engineering. I said, that's not for me.
Because of the experience.
Because of the experience first, and because also
so
of my...
So your heart was telling you something different than what you planned for.
Exactly, and I think it's the civil engineer, also people that truly convinced me to, because the interview I did, they were like very rough. Tough people and not as like human as I discovered as in the industry of restaurants. So I said, oh, no, I didn't know what to do and things like that. And I think my mom took the worst decision of her life by saying, you enjoy your experience, Marco, go back again if you want.
So she encouraged you.
Yeah, she encouraged me to go back to do another season over there just to make sure that this is one of I wanted to do, and I never came back. You know, I came back to do my school as a sommelier courses
right.
because I didn't have my paper yet in France.
But the degree or whatever.
Degree, exactly. Right. There was now all these MS and things like that back then, since I'm very old. But
not that
and
old.
And you know, I ended back to France in Epernay to do another season to really comfort myself to what I wanted to do. And after that, I said, this is what I want to do. And I applied to do my sommelier courses in Montreal. And of course, I was refused at the beginning because a civil engineer guy that wants to do restaurant, they said, that guy will stay like for 3 weeks and after he's going to leave.
Really?
Yeah.
They could decide whether they want to take him or not?
Of course, yes. Wow. And because of the profile, because there was very little people. There was only 30 people every year.
Are these the same SOM courses around the world or are they specific to Canada?
It's the same. It's all the same, but back then, you know, there was not a lot of school. You know, there was like two programs in Canada. I chose one I think it was the best. Well, so I asked them when I was in Europe to say, I want to go, I want to do it. And finally, there was a last-minute cancellation, and they said, okay, you need to be there next week. And I took the plane, and I came back, and I did my sommelier courses.
How long was that? I mean, how long?
97 until 99.
So you went back to Canada and stayed there for 2 years.
Yes.
What were you doing for a couple of years?
I was working in a summer job to pay my school and things like that. Just a little bit in restaurant, but
right.
I didn't have my diploma yet, so not a lot of credibility to work in this environment. But at the end, you know, I had a chance of winning a scholarship to allow me to come to work in Relais Château in France. So I ended up in the southwest of France, in Brantôme en Périgord. And you know, speaking English and French, there was a lot of tourists over there. So the income of the restaurant really got very high because of like talking with people. And I was fortunate. And that Relais Château that I was in was the Relais Château of the president of the Relais Château, Monsieur Régis Bulot, back then. And he said, Marco, for your career, you absolutely need to go to Paris. And this is why when he called Michel Rostand, the 2-star Michelin in Paris, and he said, I have a young guy. You need to take that guy. He wants to continue his stage over there. So I ended up in Paris at Michel Rostand.
So great guy looking out for you.
Great guy.
Rostand, like you said, 2 Michelin star.
Yeah, exactly, in Rue de Ronquin, so a great 2-star Michelin with a great program wine list, the Wine Spectator Grand Award, which I discovered back then with Alain Rosati, which was my biggest mentor because he really showed me the simplicity of wine, humility in the wine business. He's really one of the great person, and I was very lucky to meet him because after 2 weeks, you know, I was like running with all these people, and he said, you know, I just hired a young guy, but he's not the one I want. I want you to be the sommelier, my assistant. And I was supposed to go back to Canada. And I had that opportunity of staying, and I stayed for 4 years at Michel Rostand.
So what year was that? You started at Rostand when and left when?
That was December 1999.
Okay. So you stayed there 4 years?
Yes, until 2003. Yeah.
Right. Learning everything, loving everything, being taught.
Yeah, and I was very lucky because, you know, he was not the old school sommelier of
right.
France, which wants to say at the top, like pushing down the other to keep his...
Right.
So he was bringing me everywhere. Every time there was an invitation, he said, if my commis is not coming, I'm not coming. And he was very, very generous of himself for that.
So obviously you establish yourself, few connections, your guys are looking out for you. Taliban comes to an end. I mean, Rostand comes to an end. How does the next thing happen?
But actually it's still because of Alain Rosati, because, you know, I was with him since four years, and everything was going perfectly well. And I was always, like, tasting wines and going in tasting in the vineyard and things like that.
So you were all in at this point now.
Yeah, exactly.
You were tasting. You're tasting at work. tasting with friends, traveling a little.
Yeah, a lot of energy to go to see the people in all the tasting because of Alain Rosati. And one day, the general manager of Taïwan and Monsieur Vrina, they were looking for a new head sommelier, and I was 29 years old over there, and they said, oh, there's a young kid over there at Michel Rostand, maybe you need to see him, to get an interview with him. And the general manager called Alain Rosati, the head sommelier, and instead of keeping everything for him, he said, you need to go, Marco, you need to go.
Good
there
guy.
It's going to be a tough job, it's going to be like a real old school restaurant, but you need to go there. And he really encouraged me, he really forced me to go, and I had an interview with Jean-Claude Vrina and Pierre Béraud, that was the head buyer over there. And 2 weeks after, I had an appointment at DRC, Domaine de la Romanée Conti. And 5 minutes before the appointment, Monsieur Vrina called me and he said, Marco, you have the job at Taïwan 3-star Michelin. And 5 minutes after, I was with Aubert de Vilaine and Monsieur Noblet to do the tasting at DRC.
You were on your way. So you were definitely one of the younger guys doing programs at big fancy Michelin-starred restaurants, right? I mean, was there still an old guard? And
it was a very old guard restaurant, but there's...
But even in, you know, the fine restaurants in Paris and all that.
Oh, yeah, but there's one thing that I really noticed very quickly, and this is why it convinced Monsieur Vrina to do a road together. It's because I was there to work. I was there because there's a lot of, on the market back then, there was a lot of good sommelier, but there was not a lot of good manager sommelier.
Right.
Because we had like 425,000 bottles in the wine cellar. There were no more 78, 85, 1990 in Burgundy, but we had a lot of 84, 82, 80, all the underrated vintage, so somebody needed to take care of it.
Right. Yeah. Push it and all of that. So you spend how many years at Taïwan?
6 years.
6 years. That's a long time in
yes,
the business for
us.
Yes,
with all these conditions, with the old school restaurant.
Yeah, but that obviously never fazed you. You understood what you were doing, the people, right? You enjoyed it. Your passion was looming large.
It was really the old school. We could talk about, like, for 2 hours about all the intern thing, but I don't think it's the moment of doing this. But that was the old school, very, very tough school. And I don't think a lot of young sommelier can imagine how it can be
like
20 years ago in France in the 3-star.
But here's the other thing. As time went by, your wine knowledge got better and better. You understood the best producers, the best vintage years, rarities, what's cool, what's emerging and all that. By the time you were at Taïwan, did you know all of that or you were still learning stuff?
We are always learning. I know that this is all the people in that industry said, We learn every day. Of course, and in different environment, in a different restaurant, you still learn different things because you have different clients. 3-star Michelin clients are not the same than in a bistro in the 11th district, and not the same in a 2-star Michelin or 1-star.
Right.
You always improve. You always
that.
And of course the trends are changing. The way people are drinking, everything changed. So even if you think you know everything or you have your solid basis or things like that, but the wine that people like today, they're not the same than 10 years ago.
No, there's definitely been a change, and we'll talk about that. But I guess the other thing that comes to mind with me is your exposure, your experience was very Franco-centric, right? I mean, most of the wines that were being sold, drinking, tasting were French wines. So you became an expert at that quickly. But you had chances to drink.
We had chances, and I can tell you with my assistant back then, because my assistant Manuel Perrondet, which now is a MOF in sommelier, is the best sommelier of France. Now he's going for the best sommelier of the world.
Ah.
So we created everything together, the sort of new generation of sommelier, because back then there was no Instagram, Facebook, or
no.
Things like that. And you know, every first week of summer, we were going in Piemonte with our car and things like that. And it's hard to imagine that in 2003, when we were going in Piemont, all the winemakers, I'm talking about Roberto Conterno, all these people, they were saying, we're very happy to see a foreigner sommelier. There were no Americans.
You don't think of that now as you do, because guys like Conterno, Giacosta, they're gods now, but they were just farmers walking around, right?
Exactly, and this is in 2003. That's not like 40 years ago.
Right.
This is why we see that things going very, very fast. We were the first in France to bring some Piemonte wine and things like that, and we had tons of it, even at Taïwan, because we wanted to have that young generation, even if Taïwan had these old school image. But with Manuel Pirondet, we wanted to crush everything and to change everything, the whole game back then. And still a lot of people talk about this duo that we were doing with Manuel Pirondet back then as like the new upcoming generation. Now we are old, but back then we were like the new. It's always new.
And like
to
you
create.
Said, without social media, you know, without taking social pictures of you and the winemakers in the fields and all the cellar pictures you guys take
exactly.
now.
Exactly. And we were just for the little anecdote, when I was at Taïwan, I had a full locker full of 88 Musigny from Roumier. I had 48 bottles. None of them had labels. And I was going to see all our loyal clientele, said, oh, would you like to drink a Musigny for that? I have it for 250 euros if you want, but there's no label, but you'll see it on the cork. That was a whole different game back then, you know? It was about generosity, not about speculation, not about rarity. It was really...
It was a different time.
Exactly. It was a completely different time.
All right, so let's finish the chronology, because there's a ton of stuff I want to get into. So you do 6 years at Taïwan.
Yes. Monsieur Vrina died in 2008.
You're killing it. So you move to no slouch job. You move on to the Hotel Le Bristol.
Yeah, at the beginning, I didn't want necessarily leave Taïwan back then, but Monsieur Vrina died from a very radical cancer in 2008. And, you know, back then, things were changing, and I was not in phase of what was happening in that restaurant. And believe it or not, I was supposed to open the RN Savino War with Raj in San Francisco, yes. And we had 80% of the paper that were done, and headhunter called me. I was at Taïwan, and said, there's a future three-star Michelin Palace that looks for a head sommelier. And, you know, I meet all the people over there, and there was like 27 sommeliers on the road to go there. And still, again, the only thing I said, if I go with you, I just want to work. I just want to clean up everything. I want to do. And most of the people were asking for 1 week off to go in the vineyard and things like that, because people
were... You're the guy with the head down, let's get going, right?
I just said, I want to work with you. And
plus,
this is
coming from Taïwan is, you know...
Oh, yeah, that's... I didn't have one single day off in Taïwan 6 years.
Right, I'm sure you didn't get much off. So you take the job at...
At the Bristol, yes, exactly. And I stayed for 8 years.
That's a little different because Taïwan, restaurant, Bristol's hotel with restaurant, I guess bars. I mean, there were a lot more things going
on. Completely different games, yes. Yeah. Yes, you need to manage. The skill of managing is completely different because, first of all, you had 12 sommeliers under your arm because we had three restaurants, a bar, the room service, plus the catering and all these things. So it's a completely different job. So it's more management than working on the floor, even if I was doing 10 service a week at Epicure, but I needed to always have an eye on the other thing. And after that, on the way, I was managing the Hotel Cap Inn & Rock in Saint-Barth, the hotel in Seychelles, and
things like that. There are other ones.
Yeah,
they tapped into you.
Yeah, not everyone, but...
But a bunch of them.
A bunch of that, because we had five hotels, plus management, contract management on other hotels. And that was a pretty job, so I was helping them to, you know, to send some ship boat to benefit from better prices on wines and things like that. So that was a whole different game over there.
So you spent how many years there?
8 years at the Bristol, yes.
So God, Taïwan and Bristol, like
yes.
14 years.
Yes, in three-star Michelin, yes.
Amazing. So the big question is, and fill in the gap if I miss something, what compels you to leave 14 years of three Michelin, six combined, to go off and open your own place? Now, was there anything in between leaving Bristol and Vaughan?
No, there was
okay.
nothing.
So but why at Bristol, when did it start brewing that, you know, I got to do something?
It's for many reasons. I think, first of all, the human being is not made to do the same thing all his life. That's first of all.
Especially you're itchy and you want to learn and do new and different.
Being in a big hotel, it was hard because of the close of non-competition to have my little vineyard in Bordeaux, because that started while I was at the Bristol. You know, there was always some little jealousy in between of little thing because my...
Wait, so stop right there. So while you were working at Bristol, and we're going to talk about it more specifically, you acquired a plot in Bordeaux,
yeah.
And you started making wine with a couple other friends or associates. they had a minor resentment towards that, or that created a little friction when you're...
No, it's not inside. It was more at the Bristol.
That's what I meant. Oh, not yeah. With your friend, at the Bristol.
Right,
so a culmination of that and doing the same thing.
Exactly. So, you know, because, you know, when you're not there, you need to be there and things like that. And plus, you know, there was a lot of work doing 10 service every week in a restaurant, 3-star, managing all the buyings of all the hotel and things like that. And at the end, I had some serious health problem. And
then it gets hard.
And it gets hard.
If you feel fine, it's easy to get up and kill the world. But if you're dragging your ass.
But at the end, because, you know, when you're in a big hotel like that with a lot of, you know, pretension in terms of what you want to be and things like that. And, you know, I wanted to do things differently. And I was always adding things like the vineyard in Bordeaux and all these things. And at the end, I was not able to do it anymore. And I said, that's enough. You know, I should have done it like 2-3 years before. But when you're in a golden prison, it's, you know.
As all this started happening, was it in your mind at the beginning to open your own place, or?
Yeah, for sure. Because for me, doing service.
You wanted to stay in the business, your own place, more casual.
Oh, yeah. I could have stopped everything, you know, because I'm partner also with Veritas Import in California, which we're doing import completely together. We have our champagne project. I could have stayed like just.
Right, you already established in other stuff. But so you opened Vaughn, what was that, 2016?
2016, correct.
And you go, like I said, from 3-star establishments to casual. How was the transition?
The transition is very, very hard. Mostly, it's when we took the business, we took, you know, because our goal was to create it. It was not to take already a 3-star Michelin
right.
with marbles and everything. We started from
different
zero.
Concept.
When I said from zero, it was an old restaurant that never had like any cleaning up or a paint since at least 20 years.
There's a funny story I read. The place was so smelly from cooking duck that had to like scrape the walls and get the duck, right?
And when
that
I say,
screwed up.
When I said scraping the wall, it was like at least 1 centimeter of grease on the wall. And even, you know, we did the pre-opening for 3 months in the whole setting for like knowing the needs for the renovation and things like that. And we used, you know, everything, you know, we were saving like Gevrey Chambertin Premier Cru in the old, like very old school glasses, like very thick glasses.
Cool
and
stuff.
It was fun. But, you know, just to give you an example, the dishwasher was taking in fires during the service. Just to give you an idea where we were when we... And you know, and the first with Thomas Simian, that was my head sommelier.
Well, the bad news was all the crap you went through. The good news is when you started the restaurant, you were with friends.
Exactly.
People you trusted.
Exactly. So and Thomas Simian was my
you
assistant.
You guys against the world.
And trust me, the first service we do, when we print the first bill... It was not even the price for two of one glass of champagne at the Bristol.
And even then?
Even then, yes. And we look at each other and said, oh, okay, we're going to have a long road to do here. And, you know, we closed for three months to do the renovation. We started, and people really started to come and to understand what we were doing. And now, you know, we have almost all the planets that are coming to drink wine.
Right, so I want to talk a little about that place. You know, the vibe, what you set out to do, you know, the wine list. But before you tell me that, because the wine scene in Paris has been hot as far as promoting natural wines, that whole vibe and everything, people are replicating it in New York. There's more of that. What are the distinct differences between, you know, Paris and New York? And you got to go back then, because today there's a little more.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Were you coming to New York, or you were too busy, you know, in those
no,
days?
No, I was not. Honestly, for me, when I left the Bristol and people talked to me about what will be your concept of the restaurant, I said, for me, there's only one concept that hold on. It's take care of people. And I think not enough people are doing this.
Before how big the wine list is
or
what the menu is.
Of course, I'm always saying to people, I was in love with people before being in love with wines.
Now, was that banged into you at Talleyrand?
Of course.
I mean, so the good fortune of 3 Michelin star service plus the exposure to all the different elements, like you said at Bristol, you know, just managing a big crew, helping with other hotels and all that. You were lucky to land with your own place with that experience, right?
Exactly, and it's the most beautiful one ever because we are doing exactly whatever we want. And I think just to come back to what you just asked me a few minutes ago,
I think
about the trend. The problem is when there's a trend, most of the people are doing the same things, the same wines, the same thing. And I never looked. This is why, for me, social media, it's important to know, but it's not to take everything for granted in these things. You need to create your own thing. You need to create. This is why we said we are in Paris. We love what we talk about, classical wine, natural wine, the good one. And I think the both extreme are not good. So this is why in our restaurant, we are trying to stop that fight between conventional and natural wine. There's no such thing as
there
this.
There shouldn't,
you know,
be one. It's just kind of happened on its own. Different people
exactly,
are picking that
Exactly, because
fight.
There's a misunderstanding right. of what is a wine. Because if you have a person that is completely biodynamic, but it's not completely without any sulfur, so you're in the conventional wine. But if you are a natural wine grower and you put rotten grapes in your tank and things like that, I don't think it's good. But I think a great natural wine, which is close close to the conventional, because it's very precise, it's very lean. It's better than the Mouton Cadet or all these big industrial wine that you put the 150 chemical products. So I think everything is about, I'm always taking the example of an apple. You know, if you take an apple and it's organic, you forget it in your counter for 3 months. You put it out and it's rotten. Will you be eating it on the purpose that it's organic? I don't think so. Wines is the same thing.
Spoiled, yeah. It's,
exactly.
Or it's not good. It's not ready to eat. I agree with that, and that was important. So, you know, you want to take care of the customer first, but you open this wine bar with a casual wine restaurant bar with this casual vibe, but you got upwards of 20,000 bottles eventually, upwards of 5,000 selections. A lot of it came from your
exactly.
personal stuff and all that. I mean, were people doing that then? I mean,
no.
were you ahead of the game as far
nobody's doing it. First of all, because I'm way older than a lot of people that launch
and
a restaurant
you were
today.
Connected.
And I was connected, and I was buying wine excessively since many years, because I'm not a person that likes to have like the fancy cars or things like that. So my goal is it's to buy wines and to share wines with people. We are not doing a museum at the restaurant. We are opening wines. And honestly, buying wines today, it's a very expensive hobby. You know, I'm thinking of all the young kids that are like creating restaurants and things like that. It's not that they don't have the talent of doing it. It's just because it's expensive. And I had right. that chance of, you know, today Restaurant Ventre own 20,000 euro of wines. All the other ones in my wine personal, which I put consignment, and at the end of each month, my company do an invoice to the restaurant that only pay for what
right.
they consumed.
Right. You know, now in New York, you have to worry about rents. Guys
of course.
Are moving to the second floor. They're moving other, you know, besides everything else that you know and you experience.
That's a difference, yeah.
You know, one of the things about your list, which I'm sure of, is that it's pretty well appointed as far as Burgundy, good value Burgundy, but you know, knowing you and what you even mentioned in your goal is some interesting or offbeat wines, which you could walk in and get there, and you're the guy curating them. What? Just tell me about some of those wines. I mean, tell me regionally or and even of late. You know,
and honestly, if you're totally objective, you know, when I was at the Bristol or in the Fancy Palace and things like that, the only thing you know, it's Chardonnay from Burgundy, Pinot Noir from Burgundy.
Right.
Syrah from the Northern Rhone
right.
and Bordeaux.
And you're well positioned, Yvonne, but you know.
Yeah, and I was, you know, I was getting bored at the end because I didn't know anything. And I didn't want, you know, all these great producers from Savoie, from the Jura to come to the Bristol. And on the fact that I have a financial guy that said, you need to sell 450
right.
euro bottle of wine. And I said, to all these young winemakers, I said, I don't want you to lose your time. Even if you want to be at the Bristol, I will have people that tell, no, I don't want you to sell 45-euro wines in a 3-star Michelin. You know,
so
that's a whole different thing.
It makes
thing.
Total sense. But now at Vaughn, you had the canvas
exactly.
to bring these guys in and let them. So you bring in the Jura, the Savoie, all that stuff, right?
Yeah, in all the different regions, even Spain, it's super dynamic at the moment. And, you know, everything changed because all these great historical fancy wine, first, we cannot afford it anymore.
Right.
Plus, the quality is always not always at the rendezvous. And so that's why now we are going with the energetic young wine producer,
which
or
is
old wine
off
producer.
The charts. But before we talk about that for a second, you're obviously a Burgundy lover. And I think one of the nice things about the restaurant is you have a pretty good offering of reasonable Burgundies.
Yes.
Along with, you know, the expensive trophy stuff and all of that. For my listeners, because nobody knows better than you at all levels, If you wanted to drink Burgundy and you're looking for value, where do you go? I mean, do you go Region? Do you go Bourguignon? Do you go Marseille? I mean, just give me a couple of quick tips on how to drink good Burgundy at a reasonable price.
But you need to not looking at the fancy label anymore. Because these,
as far as the maker and all of that?
Of course, because otherwise, you know, right. if you want to buy a Club
Highly
Bordeaux at 500
allotted,
euro,
too expensive.
Exactly, okay. And the problem, all the young people like us, you know, when I sell wine in California and all the thing, people, you know, and they said, okay, I never tasted like some 1985 Chambertin, but they said, who cares? We will do something else, you know? Your library and your wine, your museum wines, we don't care. And that's a big whole change in that world
today. So what should I be looking for?
The wine in the haute cote, like young kids like Nicolas Faure, or all these young winemakers that are arriving in the regional appellation. But it's a shame, because the great, great historical terroir, it's impossible for us to even if you're a young winemaker, you just create your own demand, you'll never be able to, they will never be able to buy some Chambertin or things like that. So it's over.
So do you own a lot of Burgundy, but, you know, as time passes, are you buying less Burgundy and filling in
a lot less Burgundy
with Ribera Sacra and Canary Islands and Savoie and, you know,
and it's by conviction. It's not only by prices.
Right.
And, you know, there's a whole different games that it's changing, and it, a whole different game of attitude and philosophy in terms of wine. You know, I had a winemaker on the phone the other day, and, you know, he used to sell me a bottle of Grand Cru at 110 euros, which I was selling it for 280 on my list, three vintage after. He asked for the same bottle, 250 euro plus tax. And I said, what I'm doing? You know, I said, hey, if your wine are too good for us, keep it, you know?
Yeah. That's interesting. All right, Marco, we have to take a quick break. I'm talking to Marco Pelletier. Marco is the proprietor of Vaunt, and we're going to talk about Domaine de Galouchy and a bunch of other projects that Marco's involved with. You're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Square. We all know that this is an incredibly challenging time for our friends running restaurants and small food businesses. With social distancing in place, people are staying home and eating in, and restaurants have had to pivot to pickup and delivery only. HRN would usually be recording our podcast from our studio inside Roberta's, but since they've had to close their dining room, they've ramped up their frozen pizza production, set up a wine and grocery shop, and seen their delivery orders skyrocket. Like Roberta's, many restaurants have been changing offerings day by day as they figure out how to best serve their customers. If you run a restaurant or a small business, Square has the tools to help you adapt. One of these tools is the Square Online Store. It lets you set up a free online ordering page with curbside pickup and local delivery so you can keep customers safe. You can deliver orders yourself or integrate with delivery partners. Its Order Hub lets you manage all your incoming orders in one place, no matter which delivery partners you choose to use. Square has all the tools to help you stay connected to customers no matter where they are. See everything that's available by visiting square.com/go/grapenation.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Marco Pelletier. I guess we could sit here and talk about Paris, wine, and Vaughn forever. But that's not the only thing you're doing. And one of the reasons you're in New York, not at your restaurant, is because you mentioned, and you'll tell me a little about that, you make your own wine, and you're in town at a portfolio tasting to pour it out to the industry and some other people. The wine is called Domaine de Galouchy.
Domaine de Galouchy, yes.
What does that mean?
Galouchy, it's a name of a little river.
Okay.
Close to where we are, yes.
Okay. And isn't there another famous river, the Dordogne?
The Dordogne, Gironde,
right,
all these.
Right, they're all around.
Trust me, Galouchy, it's way smaller than the Gironde.
Yeah, no, I figured that. So 10 years ago when, was it the Bristol you were at?
Yeah.
You got involved. Just give me a little quick.
But actually, it's I got into evolve into that domain at the beginning of the mid-2000, where we...
20 years ago.
Yes, yes. In 2002, actually, they I said they because I was not with them at that time. Gérard Pantanach and Jean Terrat, they planted the vine in 2002. Actually, on the virgin soil, which is very important. And that was like a summer house that they had over there. And they had like 1 hectare and a half empty with only goat and horses over there. And I said, we're in the country of the wine. We need to plant some vine. And the next day they went there and they started to plant 9 grapes on more than 1 hectare.
And 9 different grapes.
9 different grapes. 4 Let's... whites and 5 reds.
Jesus
yes, exactly.
Christ. So literally some of them were just rows.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. So they decided to plant illegally the vines over there because, you know, they didn't know that we need a permit of planting the vineyard.
Wait, planting vines at all or certain types of vines?
Planting vines at all. Yes,
okay.
Yes. And, and you know, and which will lead to the Michel Gonnet family after that. Our neighbor, it's the Michel Gonnet, so they run an estate next to us. And, you know, we got 2 friends with these peoples and things like that. And, you know, fortunately, they, with their right of plantation, they allowed us
help,
you know, 3 years after, which we should done it before, but that's how it is. And so it was gone, you know. I started to be with them really in 2005, 2006, when there was the first vintage, because when you plant a vine in 2002, it's minimum 3 years to have some grapes.
And that's young.
So I didn't plant the vine, so I skipped the hardest part. And I ended up with them in 2006, starting with everything. And really, really officially, we started to vinify together in 2007.
Was the first vintage?
Yes, the first vintage ever produced of Galouche. 2008, there was a problem with a tank, so we lost everything. So that's beginners.
Not zero. In the field.
Zero.
Inside.
Inside.
The tank.
After the harvest and things like that.
So you got the juice in, something screwed up, and you couldn't use it.
Yeah, exactly. And when you know that we are...
And 09 wasn't a bad vintage year.
No, 09, 010, it was our good luck. Because, you know, great vintage, no rot, nothing. So that was good for us. 2009, 10, and even 11, which is, for me, it's a good vintage. Not with the same concentration, but that's good. And so, of course, at Galouche, we are harvesting by hand, destemming by hand. So it's a big, big job with a lot of people. You know, when we start the harvest, we have a lot of friends, and we finish with no friends at the end of the harvest because it's a very tough job.
Everybody runs for the hills, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, after that, 2012, 2013, you know, very tough vintage, you know, and since we are, I'm not allowed to say it because we're not officially organic. We're not certified.
You because practice.
Exactly, because that costs a lot of money for us, and with our tiny demand, we cannot pay for it. But we are completely organic in terms
Wait,
of...
Wait, clear it up for me. You can't pay for the certification?
Yeah, it's too expensive.
But you practice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to walk around fields and...
Exactly, but I'm not... Officially, I'm not allowed to say
right,
it.
Right.
And you know, for the treatment, you know, for when it rains and things like that, we needed to learn a lot of things. We were very lucky that our first vintage were very good vintage. But in 2012, 2013, we lost practically everything because we were going to do the treatment after the rain. And after talking with a lot of organic, biodynamic people, they said, no, you need to treat right before the rain because the rain activated the product. Beginners, you know, that's how. And now we learn a lot of things with that experiences because we didn't want to be Parisian to pay people to do our wine. We wanted to do everything from A to Z. Even if we do a lot of mistakes, we lose a lot of things, but we wanted to understand.
Trial by error, and you get there, right?
Exactly. Our goal, it was to understand something, not just to have our names on a label.
Right.
You know?
You're doing this to do it right. What vintage is in the market now?
It's the 16s are arriving this week
and
in 16, New York.
16, from what I hear, was a terrific vintage.
Terrific
for
vintage.
For you, was it good?
Yes, exactly. Because in 17, we frost at 90%.
Right.
So we lost practically everything. But actually, the 16 are arriving at the same time as the 17. But the 17, there's practically nothing. There will be 200 Magnum for the U.S. And
That's
it's completely vinified, aged, and bottled without any sulfur, only in Magnum. So since it's a very small...
Now, like, how many bottlings are there? Is it one? Is it two?
It depends on the vintage.
It does.
It's just to give you a quick example, because the Merlot grapes...
And it's a blend.
It's a blend. It's right. a blend, but it...
Predominantly Merlot?
Predominantly Merlot at 70%. We have the Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, Carmenère, and Petit Verdot in terms of reds. But, you know, when you have a vintage like 2015... which is a richer vintage, we put a little bit more of Cabernet in it because it's tightening the wine.
You tweak it based on...
And you neutralize the sweetness. For example, in 2016, it's a very fresh vintage, so we have a little bit more of Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc because otherwise we'll feel too much. So what we do is we do longer aging. We do one cuvée, which is called Le Cabernet, which is produced with only like 700 bottles or 800 bottles, but it's almost 30 months of oak aging. So we do a different specific cuvée, a little bit, I like to call it the Clos Rougeard because it's really long aging on old barrel. And Nadi Foucault, when I was at the Bristol and we did a private dinner tasting with him, he said, your wine, the texture is very nice, but what you need is longer aging. So that's why with our Cabernet, since that moment, I did long aging on the Cabernet.
So adding a little more cab. Would make it more ageable.
Yeah, exactly. It's okay. when we don't use all the Cabernet for the main Domaine de Galouche, we do a specific cuvée, Le Cabernet, which we let age for longer.
Right. So technically, you're in Bordeaux.
Exactly.
I mean, you're near Libourn, but you don't. I don't even think you put the word Bordeaux on the bottle, do you?
We're not allowed because we're declassified in Vin de France. And I'll be completely honest with you. Officially, we're not allowed because we put some white grapes in our chateau.
You're breaking every rule, Marco.
So, and it was by conviction at the beginning. Because when we started that project, it was not to sell it. It was to drink it.
Right.
So that's why...
So you do what you want.
Exactly.
So blending, you don't have to adhere, right.
Blending the white to bring a little bit of lift, of freshness for us, it was since the beginning. But that's the official reason why we are not Bordeaux. The real official one is because we don't want to be associated.
And you call it a...
Vin de jardin, garden wine, yes.
Right, which gives you a lot of leeway.
Exactly, and it's a little bit in provocation of the vin de garage that we hear for so long in Bordeaux.
Yeah, the old French Bordeaux garage wines.
And we think the wine is made in a vineyard, not in a garage.
No kidding. I have some silly suspicion that when you make this wine... because of your love for Burgundy, and that's what you came up, that it potentially is more of a Burgundian style than a Bordeaux. Am I right on that?
You're totally right. I don't like to use the Burgundian style because, you know, Burgundy, it's a little bit in trend at the moment, and it's I don't like to use things.
But I'm not bringing that up as a negative.
Yeah.
I'm using it more stylistically.
Yeah, exactly.
Not because that's what's cool now or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
The style that's been around.
And just if we want to talk about a little bit more technically when it's closer to Burgundy, what we need to understand, it's in Bordeaux, most of the chateau today, when you reach 75% of the alcoholic fermentation, they inoculated with lactic bacteria to make sure that the malolactic is finished in 10 days. Which is not the Burgundy style. So what we're doing, it's a little bit the Burgundy style. What you mean, it's when the alcoholic fermentation is finished, we put down in cool cellar all the winter, and the old guy used to say, the wine needs to do is spring, so malolactic from spring, which is a late malolactic, which is always better, and prevent to put sulfur all the winter in the wine.
It's a more natural progression in that.
Exactly.
It's less intervention or letting time and
we don't push. Yeah.
Right. Now, because I know you have a small plot and you don't make a ton of wine, I mean, is it accessible in any way, the wine?
Of course. And this
restaurants?
Restaurants. What we want today is to have prescripteur, ambassador. When I was at the Bristol, I could have sold 100% of the wine at 50 euro a bottle. But
yeah.
I never did it. My goal was to stay at 10 euros
and get it
to
out.
Be able to be served by the glass, to be able to be defended by sommelier, caviste, to say, you know, everyone hates Bordeaux today, but I'll make you taste something that it won't ruin your wallet, but you'll be able to drink something with fun.
Right. Now, I want to get into a couple other things, but I ask a lot of my guests, because I talk to a lot of sommeliers, what is inside of you, or what makes a somm want to make wine or become a winemaker. Our dear friend Raj, and we could go on and on with the list, are now making incredible wines. What is it? Is it wanting to be part of the process? Is it wanting to get off the floor? I mean,
it's, you know, in life, you know, when you do mistake, for me, I'm trying to do the mistake only one time. You know, for example, if your head sommelier asks you wine, your wine by the glass, you don't know, you make sure the next day you will never get caught again. And for me, you know, learning how to make wine, back then, no sommelier were making wines.
Right.
Okay, you know, we decided to plan.
So it you preceded the trend,
sure. It was the opportunity. It was the opportunity of being there. It was not like, again, no social media, nothing. So nobody knew. Okay, we started to do it because by conviction, because this is what we wanted to do. We had the opportunity with my two partners of doing this. We see, okay, every time I'll go in the vineyard, in Burgundy, Rhone, or whatever, when I will talk with a winemaker, I want to know exactly what we're talking about. And that was my goal at the beginning. I wanted to do, and for me, I think, you know, the winemakers, it's one of the rare business today that they do everything from A to Z. From the first cut of the pruning in the winter, the making, the farming, the bottling, the selling, is the only one that are able to do everything. You don't ask a pastry guy to do his flour and everything.
Yeah.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
So
it's a totally vertical thing.
Exactly. And for me, I wanted to go further than this, you know, to do the wine, to sell the wine, to buy the wine, and to serve it to my client at the end, and to make sure that from the first pruning on the vine until the drinking, which I'm in front of my client, it's at least 3 years minimum, and it's a whole great job, and it's a great proud when the people are happy and they said, that's good.
Yeah.
Good job.
Because you've had your hand on everything.
Exactly.
Not everybody cares to do that, but there are people that are curious.
Of course.
Like you know, that want to understand all that. We talked a little about it in the intro. You mentioned a little. You got your hands in a bunch of other stuff. Let's talk a little about that. Let's start with the Gonet thing, which is exciting because you're making a champagne. But I want to go back to one thing. When you talked about the hectare you're making Galouche at, hectare and a half, whatever,
yes.
Next door was Gonet.
Yes.
Now, I could be wrong, but isn't Gonet a champagne producer?
Exactly,
what
correct.
What was the property they had next to?
It's Chateau Lespard, which we are on the lieu-dit,
okay.
Lespard. And Charles-Henri Gonet, in 86, they bought a chateau in Bordeaux. Plus, of course, the 40 hectares that they own in Champagne since
right.
seven generation.
Right.
But that was like diversity. Like me, I was in Paris, but I have a little... So,
right.
So Charles-Henri really helped us on many, many, many things. And after a few years, when he saw what we were doing with our little Galouche wine, sell in the U.S., everywhere, in the three-star Michelin, things like that, he said, Marco, I think we should need a little bit of help in Champagne.
They love
and,
the effort.
And I said, okay, you know, you are the sleeping beauty of Champagne because we are the biggest récoltant manipulant of the Côte des Blancs. We own among the best terroirs ever, but that was a sleeping beauty, as I said. And he said, if we do everything, we need to restart everything. And in 2011, we started to work together.
So you officially were working with
yep.
Gonet.
Since 2011, I'm partner with them, yeah.
Partner to this day?
Yep.
Which is why you have a champagne project.
Exactly. So
tell me about that. So we know a little about Gonet and your connection.
So the Gonet project, it was really to launch the brand. I didn't want to have my name on anything. I really wanted to defend the Michel Gonet history, the Michel Gonet terroir, and all the possibility that the man had. And you know, we... With doing the blending together, like changing the whole philosophy in terms of farming and things like that, that was really, really fascinating. And in 2016, you know, when Antoine Gomerieux, our new chef de cave, arrived in 2014, so we started to go further in all the things. And one of my very good friends, Jean-Marc Rouleau in Meursault, we were talking. I said, we need to change all the old oak aging and things like that. And he said, Marco, if you want, I'm doing a bottling next week. I can send you some 350 liters of 3 years of Meursault. I can send you 10 barrels. He said, oh, yes, great. He sent it with the lees in it and things like that. So in 2016, we did the fermentation and the aging in it. But of course, 10 barrels when you own 40 hectares and things like that is nothing.
But that's one thing. But the experiment, the idea worked.
Exactly.
The Rouleau barrels.
Exactly.
That was what you were looking to.
It's great demi, and we all know that the best producers are the one that gets the best oak. That's how it is. And you know, he sent us 10 barrels, and we did our vinification in 2016 in it, 10 barrels. So it really leads us in the mind that we can do great thing in oak aging, but that was so little quantity that at the end, I discussed with Antoine Gomerieux, the chef de cave, and we said, 10 barrels, 4,500 bottles, it's nothing in the big things like that. Can I keep it to do my own wine? And with the Gunne family, they said, you keep it.
So you split off in a way.
Yes,
that
exactly.
That was your project.
And I'm continuing to buy some barrels full
now,
of the Gunne.
You said, can I take the 10 and do it myself? When was that? 16?
In 16. Okay. But during the tasting, you know, we harvest in September, and we did the tirage in April after the fermentation and aging. And when we tasted, we said, oh, that's very good. And after that, we had that decision of saying, okay, in compensation for the work I'm doing for you, can I do my own champagne? And he said, yes. And this is where I discussed with one of my dear friend, Rajpar, and we decided to do it together.
So Raj is coming in, and both of you will worry about the winemaking.
Exactly. So that's why now we have 16, 17, 18,
16 19. 16 in the bottle?
16 is in bottle after 10 months. But when you do a vintage...
Is it on the market yet?
No, you're allowed to commercialize it 36 months
right
after the tirage.
So we'll see it when?
In June. Now I'm working on the label now, and we did the dosing test with Raj 3 weeks ago in Paris. And it's very, very promising.
Now, I don't want to think I lost track of this. Is it still going to be around the 10-barrel production, or you can escalate that a little?
For the moment, it will be the 10 barrels.
Keep that. Okay.
Yeah, 4,500 bottles.
You'll
I think
it
it's...
I know Raj, and he's truly one of the best guys out there. Why did you bring Raj in? You're capable of doing it. I understand. Is that the reason why? Because he's just the best guy on your side?
It's not because he's the best guy. He is the best guy, and he knows exactly what I'm thinking about him. But it's really because he's one of my best friends also. We know each other since almost 20 years now. We are tasting blind tastes like until 7 o'clock in the morning. Every time we see each other, and he's a very, very good friend, and I think it was kind of fun of doing it together.
I want you to explain to these guys, not to me, I get it. Is Raj the best palate without any wine certification?
Yeah, blind taste, yes, of course. Even if you will say that the first time we met, we got into a fight, but
right.
I'm the only one to not remember that, but he's probably right because he got a great memory.
All right, so let's quickly go through a couple other things. So that's the partnership with Gonne, which now I understand goes back and how this project came about, the 10-barrel story, is what I'm going to call it. Veritas Imports, you mentioned, is an importer, wholesaler, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. He's one of the oldest one in California.
Right, and their job is to bring the wines into that market, California,
Exactly, but not only these wines. It's because...
No, I meant, their portfolio.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then... Does this stuff still exist? I mean, you're like the CEO of these companies I never heard of. Wine Ted?
Yeah, this is my company I brought in 2011 because I'm doing a lot of private tasting for businesses in Paris.
And, so it's a consultation thing?
Consultation, okay. But mostly animation, animated tasting.
Right. And you're the guy to do that.
Yeah.
And I picked up on something else. Crew distributors? Is that?
We just launched with my assistant, Thomas Simion, that was my health sommelier. We just created a distribution company in Paris, which we do wines for restaurants and things like that. Now we have just a little bit more than 10 domain.
So that's got some upside.
Exactly, and business. It's getting really, really there, and we're getting better. We have a lot of very good partnership. We don't want to take like big houses or things like that. Everything we want
to
defend.
You'll curate your own list and all that.
Exactly, right. And this is what we want to do, and the crew, it's getting there, yeah.
Are you going to distribute the Gonne project through crew?
The Gonne project is already there,
okay.
And we're going to distribute the wines of Domaine de la Côte from Raj in Paris in 2 months.
Oh, you're going to bring that over?
Yeah, it's already sold, so, it's...
Yeah. So, like you said before, man, you're going totally vertical.
Yeah, I'm trying, yes.
Now, this is like asking a parent, what's your favorite kid? But of all these projects... does something tug at you more than the other? Are you passionate about one more than the other?
The restaurant.
The restaurant is your...
The restaurant, it's the little diamond that makes everything shine.
You love that.
Yeah. For me, if I stop taking care of people and...
That's in your blood.
Exactly.
I wasn't sure you were going to answer that.
As long as I could do it as like physically talking, I will do it because right. I really love it. And I want to help, you know, kids because it's a school, you know, Ventre, it's a school. There's young kids that are coming. They're right. learn about wine. They have the accessibility of tasting a lot of wine and things like that. And for me, this is what I want to continue to do as long as I could physically.
I love hearing that. All right. We have a few minutes left. I don't let any of my guests leave without answering my wine list. Five questions. I ask the same five questions to everybody. Raj Parr answered these. Kathy Corson was on last week. She answered them, so you're getting the fave one. Same ones. The first question is, what are you drinking now? What's in your fridge? What's on the table? What's interesting for the restaurant? Not what you drink all the time. What's seasonal?
Yeah, you're really right to mention about seasonal, because the wines that you drink in the middle of the winter and in the summer are not the same. But what I like to have in my fridge at the moment, it's very often some Gueuze, some beer, you know, the beer which is made like champagne, old oxidized lambic.
How do you and spell Gueuze?
G-E-U-Z-E.
Right,
Gueuze. And this is what I like to have, for example, the Cantillon, which is one of the greatest beer right. on the planet. I love sake.
Is that a sour beer?
Exactly. Yeah, okay. It's very high acid, right. and it's a beer which is made like champagne, right. double fermentation.
And Cantillon being one of the best examples. All right, what was the second thing you said?
Sake. I'm a big fan of sake, but not all the category of sake. I love the Junmai Daiginjo, the more pure one.
So Junmai.
Junmai and Junmai Daiginjo, yes. The right. non-reduced and non-fortified one. I think they're very pure. They're like a samurai blade, and they're very like iodine, like rocks water, and I really love that. And of course, all that new generation of winemakers that wants to do wine as a beverage, not as a competitor wine.
Give me an example.
For example, Pifferling in Tavel, you know, very nice, precise, with a lot of identity wine, but you know that you want to drink. It's not only the bigger is better. You know, like wines right. that it can be, I know that you don't like that word today, but wines which can be very crunchy, but with a lot of identity.
That's Raj's favorite word, crunchy.
And I
right.
really,
very
I really
drinkable.
Love that. Yeah. Drinkable, exactly, but with yeah. a lot of identity.
Right,
yeah.
All right, so those are good ones. This is the goofiest question on the list. Favorite wine and food pairing? Obviously not something you eat every night, even serve it. But what makes sense to you?
What makes sense for me, it will be the easier one, but it's a really great Chateau Chalon from François Rousset Martin with a 30-month Comté cheese. That's the best example of what is a wine pairing and food pairing in the world. Nothing else.
So first time that wine, not the first time people have paired with Comté and aged Comté. Because that's a good one. All right. We'll figure out how to dissect this one. Tell me your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. And these are places, and it's basically Vaughn. It's people that are passionate about it, like to talk about it, have a selection. Doesn't necessarily have to be as big as yours, but it's curated. And the food is good, or as a bar, it's good. Tell me a couple of places in New York, if you can identify, and anywhere else, whether it's Paris.
In New York, definitely, I will go. It's some publicity for them, but I think they really deserve it. It's Pascaline Lepelletier at Racine.
Always comes up.
Definitely, because
that's
she's doing a great
favorite.
Job. Yeah, and I really go there practically every time. It's not just because
I agree.
Heard of it.
Arno and Diego. I mean, it's like you. You have a very good chef. You have a very good list, and you have people that are, you know.
And you have a good identity also around it.
Yes.
That's very good. And I will do
that. Here's the secret, and tell me if I'm wrong. Wasn't that a French wine bar initially?
Probably. But I think, you know, the people really have that devotion on wines. But if you want to come back to not necessarily French, there's another great restaurant wine bar in San Francisco, which is called Verjus.
V-E-R-J-U-S.
I think they really deserve a lot of publicity because they're doing a great job, and you have a lot of very passionate people over there. And I was blown away by what they were doing over there. So that's a very good place I love over there.
Those are two good ones. And I didn't tell you this, but I post all the answers. We post your wine list.
Okay, I think they really deserve
it. And the other
it,
wines
yes.
we talk about and all that. And you kind of disclaimed it a little. I ask this because who better than guys like you to tell me? I don't want you to be exclusive. Obviously, there's other places that are good and you have friends. But, you know, I'm just saying pick one of them out. And, you know, if you come to New York and you go to Racine's more than others, that's why they should be mentioned by
exactly
like you,
exactly
you know?
And
that's all I was looking for. All right, fourth question, we discussed this a little earlier, favorite all-time wine, and that now means a wine that's important to you or resonates or, you know, had some important moment. And if there's a few,
there's a few, but I'll go on a wine which not a lot of people had the chance to taste. If you have one day, is because I was very close to Patrick Bies from Domaine Simon Bies, and he died of course unfortunately in 2013. And one of his favorite wine, and I was completely agreeing with him, it was the Vergelès, Savigny Vergelès 2003. I think it was
spelled Vergelès.
Vergelesses.
Two S's.
Vergelès. Okay. It's a little bit like the most prestigious Premier Cru they have at the Domaine. And Patrick was a brother. I was very, very close to him. And that was a very, very great wine. I still have some at the restaurant, but they're not on the list.
And that's an important wine to you.
Yes.
That's how you answer that question. Yeah. All right, last question. You're doing good. I know you're breathing heavy, but we're almost done. Recommend to me best wine around $15-$20 US. I mentioned earlier, my kids are in their 20s. They can't show up at parties with supermarket wine. They can't afford $40. So how do you impress somebody at $15, $20, $22? I need you to give me a red, a white. You can give me region, maker, both, everything.
But definitely, I would say in terms of white, if you want, because I always like to have identity in the wine, I think it's really possible still in this world, because I think it's really the biggest and the greatest terroir of all time. I think this is the Chablis terroir. I think you're allowed, without necessarily going on Ravenau and Dovisa, but I think you can have some very, very good wine for really good price quality average.
Is this like
Chablis
petite and village level?
Petit Chablis.
Is that where the values are?
Of course. Okay. If we want to talk about really great identity wine, we can find some Chardonnay from everywhere else on the planet or things like that. But I like to think that all the new generation of kids that will try wine, they will look for identity in the wine, from where it came from or something like that.
That's what's important to them.
There's no obligation of intellectualizing the wines, but I think if they can know that, oh, wow, that smell a little bit oysters, where does that come from?
The story.
Exactly. Right. So for me, Chablis, I think it's really one of the best example. The second one, I think, that really, really are upcoming with all the new generation of winemakers and farming, plus a little bit the global warming, I think is the Pinot Noir from Alsace. I think they're doing a great, great job over there.
So because of the climate change, to some extent?
A little part of it.
Besides the fact that they're making good wine.
Yeah, exactly. And they have an all different reflection on the vegetal. And they really think now that they can do great wine without looking like Burgundies, without looking like Sancerre Red, but just looking like red Pinot Noir from Alsace. And I think they can do great, great wine over there.
Those are good ones. So that's your red, that's your white. All right, we got to wrap up. Usually at this time I do a segment called the Weekly Wine Sip where we taste wine, but because everyone's running around, it was hard to get wine. But what I may do is meet up with you tomorrow and maybe with the head mic, just take a minute or two to, you know, throw the galushi over the tongue and see what we get out of it.
Okay, I only have 4 bottles, so make sure you come a little bit early.
Okay, I'll be there, don't worry. All right, we got to wrap up. Let me do a wrap up, Marco, and I'm going to let you go. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. You could follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation, on Instagram, we're at SBenRuby, on Twitter, we're at BenRuby, but you can always use the hashtag The Grape Nation on both. As I mentioned, I'll post all of Marco's wine recos and his wine list answers And we may add a little weekly wine sip to it on all our social media sites. Marco, if people want to follow you, the restaurant, the wines, there's a handful of stuff there. Where's the best place for people to go social?
The best place in social, we are not very good at it like European people, but Restaurant Ventre on Instagram, you can find us.
It's at restaurant?
Yeah, at the restaurant.
V-A-N-T-R-E.
Yeah,
okay,
restaurant, yes.
Anything with Galushi?
Not really.
Okay. But I think if you Google it,
yeah, yeah,
you
and know, on Grand my private...
Grand Cru selection will come up, there'll be info.
Exactly,
and
everything I do outside the restaurant usually is on my personal Instagram account.
Okay. What's your personal account?
Pelletier Marco.
So it's your name backwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you're dyslexic.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, so that's the other one. If you want to just follow Marco, Pelletier Marco, which is his name, like I said, reversed. All right, Marco, got to say goodbye. I want to thank our guests, Marco Pelletier. Pelletier. I want to thank everyone at Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.